who is general manager for Consolidated Beef Producers, a feeder-owned cooperative that markets cattle to packers on behalf of their feeder members. Next to Bruce, we have Dave Domina, an attorney with Domina Legal Group. He's also the lead attorney in the Pickett IBP case. Next to Dave, we have Mark Dopp, Senior Vice President with the American Meat Institute. Next to Mark is James Herring, immediately to my right, President of Friona Industries, a feedlot company with four lots in North Texas. To my immediate left is Bob Mack, a cow-calf producer and feeder in South Dakota. Next to Bob is Bob Miller, rancher and deputy director for the Division of Tribal Affairs for Muscogee Nation. To Bob's left is Bill Rischel, cow-calf producer in Nebraska and president of the Nebraska Cattlemen's Association. And finally, all the way to the left end of the table, is Charlie Rogers, who is owner-operator of Clovis Livestock Auction in New Mexico. We're going to cover two broad topics, and as you might guess, we're going to be kind of integrated across panels. We're going to be talking about some topics that you've heard a little bit about already. I want to start the panel off talking about some issues related to concentration and competition in the fed cattle business. And then I want to shift over to a discussion about marketing practices. Let me start with concentration questions. As we've heard the broad numbers in several different panels. That is about 80% of the fat cattle in the country are purchased by the four largest packers in the country. We found in the investigation of the proposed JBS National merger last year that through most of the High Plains, most sellers faced 3 to 4 bidders, a number that we've heard in a few earlier discussions. So I want to start off and talk about the nature of concentration in different elements of the business. So let me start with James Herring and ask him, in your experience, do you typically face 3 to 4 potential buyers for your cattle, and do you think that's an accurate representation of the situation in the High Plains?
Well, first of all, Jim, thank you for allowing me to begin this panel and for being here in the first place. Looks like we've got a lot of interested participants out there. And I need to introduce, at least at the beginning, that we are a relatively large cattle feeder in the Texas Panhandle. We have worked for the last 13 years to create a vertically aligned production system into a series of brands that we put into Safeway and Harris Teeter and some other retailers. All of our cattle are merchandised in a formula based off the cash market, so we have our antenna up on the cash market at all times. And I might add that I have, as the president of the Texas Cattle Feeders in 1996, I was instrumental in getting the ball rolling on a cooperative called Consolidated Beef Producers, who's also represented on this panel. We have 3 to 4 packers out in the Texas Panhandle that participate on a very aggressive basis. We are lucky as a region because our packing community has excess capacity. We have kill capacity that's above our supply by about 15%. So if you own 100 head, you own 100,000 head, you market 2,000 head a week, you market 100 head a week, if you're feeding in the right spot and you have the right kind of cattle, desirable cattle, keep in mind that regardless of what anybody tells you, there are differences in value in livestock. Regardless of that, we have an active participating marketplace out there with four interested parties that are trying desperately to fill up their capacity every single day and every single week. And that creates a pretty stimulative marketplace.
Let me just follow up a little. I've had several other people involved in the feeding business on the panel. Is that your experience, for example, Bob Mack? Do you see 3 to 4 buyers? Or
no, in most cases, three would be the max. Normally we've got one or two. As smaller feeders, and the feeders that I work with are smaller feeders, I don't think there'd only be a few of them that would market 10,000 plus head a year. If you're in the cash market, you're a residual market, and basically once the packers that are in the market have their captive cattle killed, then they come into the cash market. And quite often, I think buyers are even just a little bit lazy about it. They go, they start out with the biggest lots that might sell some cash cattle and work their way down.
So is it generally true that we would expect people with greater volumes to have more bidders for their cattle? Is there a relationship between bidders and the number of cattle?
Well, I think the example was 100 head a week or 100,000 head a year or 100 head a year. And in our market's a weekly market, so 100,000 head a year is about 1,800, 2,000 head. And we're lucky in that we have an active participating marketplace out there, and as I mentioned, kill capacity is pretty vigorous. So in my mind, again, pick the right feeder, pick the right cattle, you have aggressive participation for the purchase.
Jim, if I could comment on that as well. You know, at CBP, we've been in business now for 10 years and market a lot of cattle. Many of you here in the room as well. And we're the largest marketer of cattle in the negotiated market in the country as a co-op, organized under the Capra Volstead Act. And we see the market function every week, not just within a region, but across regions. So we have a pretty good feel for what's going on in the marketplace as it relates to bidding. And while potentially there are four market participants, you know, what we see typically region by region is that there are really one to two meaningful participants. Rarely three, and four meaningful participants is very much of an oddity. And one of the things that we value very greatly at CBP is that we're very data-driven, number one. We work week in and week out to understand the markets. Each market is different. A lot of dynamics going on. Conditions change, so we study them in great detail. So we tend not to lend ourselves to what we subjectively believe, okay, but what is objectively true. We're very data-driven, as I said. So let's just look at the data, what the data does say about bidding in the marketplace. And we did our own assessment and challenged ourselves very deeply on this, and we looked at the last 52 weeks in Texas, Oklahoma, and New Mexico. And in the last 52 weeks, there were three meaningful market participants five weeks. Only 2 weeks were there four meaningful market participants. So a total of seven over a 52-week period could be defined as perfect competition. Additionally, there were 18 weeks in which there was only one market participant, 4 weeks in which there were none. So a total of 22 weeks, we had a market that was defined as imperfect competition. So we consistently see region by region where we have a presence where the region is dominated by one buyer, clear and simple. And the fundamental reason that we see this kind of procurement behavior going on is because of the large volumes of the non-negotiated supplies that are already committed. And I'll tell you this, it's guys, we as an industry, we have to recognize the problem, because it's not just a problem to the negotiated market, it's a problem to the entire health of the U.S. cattle industry.
Let me keep just a brief follow-up for now on the concentration side. In particular, in the areas that Clem Ward and the previous panel described as fringe areas, perhaps outside the High Plains. Then if you have experience or want to comment on the number of buyers we tend to see in areas outside the High Plains.
The numbers will generally be less, and a lot of times you're dealing with regional packers, but it's not uncommon. When we deliver cattle, we're hauling cattle 200 to 800 miles quite often. So there's other factors involved there too, but I agree with him when he says that it's not only the cash cattle that are being affected, it's also, that's establishing the price for many of the captive cattle. And so when that market is depressed, it's actually driving the captive market down also.
Let me get one more quick one since you brought up distance. Are those distances for fat cattle?
Yeah, one way.
It's a long way. Now, I've talked a little bit about numbers, and Bruce touched briefly on volumes and bidder numbers. Let me follow up a little bit with Bruce and see if we also want to have other people jumping in on this. Bruce, do you also see that volume matters in the types of prices that you're able to get? In other words, do you get price premiums related to the volumes of cattle that you're selling in particular transactions?
I think in any industry, yes, volume does matter. It does speak. Whether you're talking agriculture or the airline industry, it doesn't really matter. What does matter is taking time to understand the marketplace and studying. We at CBP strongly believe that you have to get in and study the business week in and week out to understand the dynamics and the conditions of each marketplace. Markets change not because of some whim. Markets change because of fundamental supply and demand, and you have to understand that. And there also has to be a balance in terms of buying and selling power. That is a business strategy in any industry.
Wasn't sure I got an answer out of you. Do you get higher prices for when you're selling more cattle?
Oh, yes,
transaction?
Absolutely. Yeah. At times there are, and in the last 8 weeks there have been numerous two-tiered markets. So yes.
Two-tiered meaning a premium for volume in a transaction?
Meaning that the market begins at one level and then goes to another level during the week.
We mentioned that. Let me see if we get others following up as well, though, because we did have a little bit of discussion in earlier panels on volumes and prices. And I'd like to see if other panel members have a view on this. Do you need a particular threshold or significant volume of cattle to be sold in order to get a price premium? Are there volume premiums in the market?
Well, it might be worthwhile to look at the data that the packers report to you. The mandatory price reporting data doesn't indicate that there's any difference for volume, but it indicates a very large packer-reported difference from packer-reported data between cash prices paid and non-cash prices paid. From 1994 through August 10 of this month, that difference was a little over $21 a head. That's one of the problems. The other problem is if the question and the answer don't necessarily match up, the data isn't very good. The first question you asked today was, what is the market level activity that's seen at Friona Industries? And the answer included the word vertical and then described the market. I think I'm right that Friona Industries sells 100% of its cattle under a contract arrangement to Cargill. And if that's so, there's no bidding for those cattle by those other three packers. So the data has to match the question in order to be meaningful.
I'll give James a chance to respond on that.
Well, the answer to that, as I mentioned earlier in the comments, was yes. We do trade our cattle in the formula because we spend a lot of time and effort downstream to acquire the cattle that can perform against today's pricing parameters in the marketplace. So even though the choice select spread is relatively tight now, and there are other little nuances in the marketplace for premiums and discounts, obviously we design the cattle to fit the formula and the pricing mechanism that exists in the marketplace at the time. So yes, we do use the cash market to represent a base price for what comes to us, because we spend a lot of time and effort based on tenderness and our 27 critical control points to create a differentiated product for the retailer and the consumer. So, yeah, I'm not embarrassed to say I'm chasing a premium every single day. I want the premium. I want my cattle producers that deliver to us. There's 82 of them across about 28 states. I want those people to be well rewarded as well. So, you know, I've heard a lot of commotion here today about vertically aligned production system, but you're going to hear this afternoon in some comments from producers that are in a vertically aligned production system that it's not that bad. We pay them, and we're in the marketplace 24/7 with premium prices for the cattle that we know will perform. Don't ever let anyone tell you that livestock are the same, because they're not. In our 13-year progress to this branded product scheme that we have now, there's $400 difference in the cattle from pen to pen any time in the Texas Panhandle. You walk into any pen of cattle in the Texas Panhandle that's traded on the commodity basis, a commodity price, cash price, and there's $400 difference. So all we're trying to do is mine those differences. And we have a way to do that, and we're proud of that. And people down below us, you guys sitting out here in this room, 650,000 times a year, somebody has a grin, a smile on their face from something that we've done.
And that's called premium selling. And the reason it's called premium selling is because if a packing plant kills 5,000 head of cattle a day and operates for 8 hours a day, it operates for 28,800 seconds. Divide that by 5,000, and it takes 5.8 seconds to kill and to harvest an animal. And that doesn't allow differentiation in the packing plant. That is premium selling.
Can I respond to that, too? We'll get a real discussion going here.
Sorry, me.
Here's the real discussion. The USDA has spent a lifetime creating a grading system that says to the rest of the world, retail and the consumer, hey, we want you to know the differences in livestock. That's not a bad thing. That's a good thing, because there are differences in livestock. And the GPSA regulation, as it's written today, would take that methodology, that attempt to differentiate the meat within an animal, and to the producer not allow that. Does that make any sense to any of you sitting out in the room?
It's absolutely not true.
Let me try to hold us off. I still want to stay with concentration a little bit before we get into arguing over marketing practices. So let me just take a little bit more time on some of this. As Dave pointed out, a large kill plant today will slaughter about 5,000 cattle a day. Actually, I think it's in two shifts they'll make 5,000.
It takes 10 seconds.
If I go back a little... two kill lines. If I go back a little bit further, back when concentration was low, 1980, the top four packers owned about 26 plants. Today, the top four packers with concentration of 80 own about the same number of plants. Those plants are a lot larger. We all know that. We didn't have plants killing 5,000 a day in the early 80s. What I want to do is take a little bit of time to talk about something Clem Ward mentioned in the past panel, which is whether there are scale economies and what extent they are in packing plants. In short, I want to get around to the several drivers that are driving us towards higher concentration. So I'd like to ask Mark Dopp, do packers realize any cost or efficiency advantage from these large annual or large transaction volumes?
Well, first of all, thank you, Jim, for allowing me to be here today. The short answer is yes. The data is indisputable. In fact, I heard somebody discuss this issue very recently, last night, and I think it was described as a fairly boring topic to analyze because it's so well founded, so well discussed, and so well proven that economies of scale matter very much in this business. The data that I was given recently, provided recently, shows that, for example, a plant that kills 1.7 million head on an annual basis is 5% more efficient than a plant that kills 1.3 million head and 12% more efficient than a plant that kills 950,000 head. Now, 950,000 head is still a lot, but when you're talking about efficiencies on the scale of 12%, that's a big number. So the short answer is yes. And it's not surprising, therefore, that companies started looking at ways to become more efficient, getting larger, to achieve those efficiencies, those economies of scale. Now, there's something I would like to talk about for a minute, and I'm not taking issue with your data, Jim, but something that nobody's mentioned all day, and something I hear about a lot, is this, quote-unquote, increasing concentration. All right. Well, the facts are, if anybody wants to go to the GPSA website and look at the 2009 report, which was published in March of 2010, you will see that for fed cattle, the concentration, the CR4 number, the concentration ratio, is at about 80%. And it's been there since 1995. It hasn't changed more than about a percent. Go to page 45. It's in the report. So this idea that there's increasing concentration in the cattle industry or in the fed cattle industry is a bit of a red herring. Now, admittedly, it grew dramatically from 80 to 95. That's when you move from 30 to 80%. But since 1995, that number hasn't moved much at all. In fact, you can talk to some economists who will tell you that it's probably about 70%. So, in fact, I looked at the report this morning. For steer and heifer, it's 81%. In 1995, in 2008, the most recent data that the agency publishes, it's 79%. For fed beef production, 85% in 1995. 2008, again, the most recent data they put out, 76%. So there is a bit of there's some disingenuousness, if that's a word, out there about this increasing concentration. It just hasn't happened, not recently. Now, there are some very good reasons why the concentration has gotten there. And some people have talked about, there are OSHA issues and EPA issues. Let me mention one other because I'm intimately familiar with it. Some of the government regulatory policies that USDA has put out have contributed or foster that concentration level. And I'm thinking about the food safety policies. And I'm not up here, I'm the first to tell you that we are all in favor of the most stringent food safety policies out there. But I can tell you as a fact, because I represented them. I represented a company that some of you know in Nebraska that went out of business in 1997 because of an E. coli recall. That recall, that policy, led to at least two other companies leaving the business. I represented those companies. They sold out. They were family-owned operations. And the folks that ran those companies said, I'm not taking the chance of being the next Hudson Foods. So they got out. Those types of things contribute to what everybody calls, quote, unquote, the concentration issue.
So if I can just jump back briefly and put it in the past tense then, when it became concentrated. Do we have a sense of why that happened? Aside from scale economies and bigger plants, are there other issues involved in the increase in concentration that occurred during the 80s and 90s? And I agree with you. The major structural change in the industry occurred during the 80s and early 90s. Anybody want to take a shot at that?
Well, I think what was discussed a little bit about the retail sector has contributed somewhat to that. I think the issues there, however, are far more related to the cattle marketing issues, which you want to get into. But I think the evolution in the retail sector contributed perhaps a little bit.
Well, I'll take a shot at it. First of all, I think the only place you could be employed in the livestock industry and have the sense that the market is unchanged for the last 20 years would be as a lobbyist for the Packers.
I'll tell our lobbying people that. The second
thing I would say is that surely one of the reasons that concentration came to be, continues to grow, and gets worse is because packers with large plants are able to cut up more pieces of meat by the pound, by the hour, for the same wage as if it was a little bit smaller, which creates the marriage between the workers who are here and the producers who are here. We have the same problem. The third thing about concentration is answered with a simple rhetorical question. 64% of the deposit assets of the United States of America, including its federal treasury, are in four banks. If you feel safer about your country because of that, raise your hand. And if you don't, then why would you think your food supply is safer at a higher level of concentration than your money?
Jim?
Bob, do you want to follow?
Hey, Jim?
The other question, I got a quick question for Mr. Dopp, is what would the concentration level be if the Justice Department hadn't blocked the most recent JBS merger?
I think that it would be at 80%. You'd have three firms at 80%, not four. It's still 80. You're marrying three and four.
No,
and by the way, Jim, I might make an observation about the food safety comment that was made. You know, I think there's been a lot made about that, and I think it's frankly some people need to learn the facts. The for example, when E. coli 157H7 was declared an adulterant in about 1994, 1993, the incidence rate on products coming out of U.S. Federally inspected packing plants was about 1%, maybe a little higher. It's now at 0.1%. So to suggest that the packers aren't doing a good job at dealing with the E. coli issue, I think is just not true.
Jim, can I comment one time on concentration?
Sure. I need to get somebody from the left, but as long as you guys are talking, that's great.
The numbers on concentration, they are what they are. But the reality is that on a regional basis, because of the concentration, it allows for market power. And then because of procurement practices, that creates lack of competition.
Let me get us to a last question on this section of concentration. Suppose I'll just put it straight, since Bob brought it up. Suppose a merger had gone through and we had one less buyer. Let me throw it out and ask, would prices have gone up? What would the effect of fewer bidders, one fewer bidder, no matter what we're starting from, have been on prices? I'll let Dave start with that one.
Well, if you're only getting one bidder and the number goes down, the price goes down because you get none. But I think that Bruce is right, that there are huge sectors of your industry. You know them, you live them, you experience them, where feed yards are getting one bid, one bidder. They only get one person who calls on them from one company. They sell their cattle to one place, whether they're in the cash market or not, and that's because they have one opportunity. It's not just four-firm concentration in the industry nationwide. It's sort of like politics. All cattle selling is local, and if you don't have somebody calling on your yard, you're not selling your cattle. I hear twos and threes, but when you hear it from people who are using formula sales, you wonder why, if there's such a vibrant market. I think Bruce has got it exactly right. Concentration cannot get worse than one, except to go to zero.
Well, let me put it then to the two of you. Had that merger gone through, would there have been no effect on price, since everybody already faced just one?
I think there would have been a dramatic effect on price had the merger gone through. Because rather than the few weeks that we have right now, perfect competition, we would have even fewer weeks of perfect competition.
Yeah. Okay, argument is you would have had more weeks in which you'd have a single buyer.
Yes.
Anybody else want to take a shot at that, up and down, Mike?
I agree with everything he said, but at the same token, I think part of the problem with concentration is that historically cattle have been fed where they can be fed the most efficiently and for the least money. And right now you've got the packing influences in the South where you've got some huge feedlots. The unfortunate thing is things in hit or have changed with feed prices and things like this, you know, ethanol production and other things. And cattle can be produced cheaper once again in the Corn Belt, especially the Western Corn Belt, than they can on the High Plains. Shipping costs, irrigation costs, a lot of these things have factored in. But the influence of the packers over these large lots, they've been kind of joined at the hip and actually magnified the effect of that concentration.
Look, you brought that up to me in our earlier conversations. I want to see if we've got other people saying the same thing. As I understand it, you believe that there is a fundamental change in the economics of feeding that starts to favor more Corn Belt and Northern Plains operations. Is that right?
Initially, cattle feeding was done in the Corn Belt when irrigation opened up the High Plains, and you had a huge supply of feeder cattle, and you could raise lots of corn very inexpensively. Cattle feeding naturally went and followed. The packers built packing plants there. The big feedlots went in there. Historically now, if you go and take USDA numbers and track the corn prices in the eastern Dakotas, North Dakota, Minnesota, Iowa, Nebraska, compare them to the Texas Panhandle, then add in ethanol byproducts, soybean byproducts, forage costs, the availability to high-quality Northern Plains feeder cattle and everything else, historically, cattle feeding should be moving back to the north. The packers should be moving back to the north and things like this. But you're not going to see it because you've got huge feedlots down there joined at the hips with the packers. They could care less about how inexpensively beef can be raised so the consumer can go and get a better buy, so the feeder cattle producer can go and get more for his calf. All they're concerned about is to get more control of that market.
Any reactions on that? Does anybody else see that economics changing? Have a sense?
Jim?
Bill, yeah. Bob Miller, I'm sorry.
I'm probably one of the older ones in here, and I've seen an awful lot of changes from the time we loaded cattle on, drove them 15, 20 miles to the railroad and load them, take them to Kansas City. And they'd be steers 3 or 4 years old that weighed from 12 to 1,500 pounds off grass. And then people that raise corn in Iowa and Illinois and Kansas and Missouri bought those cattle and fed them a little bit and killed them. And so we've seen the markets, as Bob said, change from Chicago, Kansas City. Well, we even had two packing companies in Oklahoma City and sold fat cattle there. We've seen all that change to the panhandle of Texas and Oklahoma. And it has caused concentration, and it has put a lot of people in a bind in different places. And it's kind of where you're looking from. It's kind of like the two old maids that lived together, and they called the police and said, there's a man next door that's indecently exposed. Would you hurry up here? Come up here and arrest him. So the police got up there and looked across the alley and said, well, I can't see him, but just from the waist up. She said, well, get up here on this table. So it's kind of where you are in this program. Yeah. And you have to be in somebody else's shoes to really see what their problem situation is. I can't see that concentration is a good thing, but we have to agree that the packers and the feeders, for that matter, are much more efficient. But when one company owns the cattle, the feed, feed yard, and packing house, to the ordinary cowboy, it looks bad.
With that, that gives us a nice introduction, I guess, to talking about cattle marketing issues, something we've been coming back to all through the day. Before I get there, though, let me remind you of something I should have said right at the beginning, which is we have these volunteers in green shirts, Colorado State students going up and down the aisles. They've got some pencils, they've got some notepads. They're using those notepads, I see, to fan themselves, which is probably a good idea. If you have questions that you'd like to have the panel address, give a nod to one of our volunteers. They'll give you a piece of paper. You pass it back to them, and I got a couple coming right now that I can take a look at. And we'll get a look and see if we can work them in. While they're there, though, while you're doing that, let me shift on to talking a little bit about alternative marketing arrangements and cash market volumes. And I'd like to ask Bill Rischel. I know that you've been involved in Angus programs for many years. I'd like to get your sense of why we're seeing shifts to alternative marketing arrangements and declines in cash market sales.
Jim, I hope you'll bear with me here if I can make one statement before I get to that. There's been a lot of different opinions offered in this room today about a lot of different issues. And I'd like to offer one that's been touched on by several people earlier in the day and some folks who spoke at the microphone. My biggest disappointment of this event was the fact that the first panel of the day up here, which included the Secretary of Ag and the Attorney General, state's Attorney Generals, Assistant Attorney Generals, and a Commissioner of Agriculture, and talking about sustainability of this industry and bringing young people back. And the bottom line is that the death tax, which will come revert back to 2001 on midnight of December 31st this year, if something isn't done about it, will be the most devastating thing to this industry and the advancement of our operations and bringing young people back. And I would implore everybody in here. I would implore everyone in this room to contact your congressmen, your congresswomen, the folks that were at this table earlier today. They have power in this administration, and that is how we start the process of maintaining the farms and ranches of this country and bringing them back. Thanks, Jim, for that. Let me do that. My family and I are just a simple, small family operation. My wife and I, we raised three kids. They're all grown and have moved on. Our daughters married guys that were extremely good athletes, didn't have necessarily an ag background, and I jokingly say I love them all, but I jokingly say there's not a damn good cowman in the whole bunch of them. But seriously, they're great folks, and I'm tickled to death, but what we did was primarily when they were young and my wife and I struggling to make this thing happen. We did not inherit a place. We developed this on our own. My love has always been in the registered Angus business, the seed stock business. It's always been about developing genetics. And I can tell you that only about one other time today did I hear anybody talk about beef demand. And for some reason, a lot of people in our industry do not believe that beef demand has anything to do with this process. And I think it has everything to do with the pricing and value of our cattle. That beef demand, if some of you have really looked at this, from 1980 to 1998 was cut absolutely in half. Had that kept going in the direction that it was going, we could have been addressing an industry at some point here that would have been similar to the young fellow that was on the end of the earlier panel in the sheep business, an industry that has almost disappeared off the face of the earth in this country. They're still in areas, some of them being very successful with it, but the bottom line was there was not a great promotional program in that, or an added value kind of a program, and they just dwindled in numbers dramatically over time. I see similarities in the beef industry, and what we did was, from a genetic standpoint, in developing the kind of genetics that we thought our customers could use to improve the genetic value and therefore the economic merit of their cattle, was structured sire evaluation work, because those traits are so highly heritable, that we knew that our customers could certainly make these cattle better than the average. Whether the cash market was 80% or whether it's 50%, and I don't know anybody smart enough to say what is an ideal cash market or an ideal balance, but I will say this, the cash market is an average of the cattle. And they're going to buy those cattle to range where they're pretty sure that the upper end of that lot of cattle or group of cattle will be good enough to be able to be pieced out into the industry to cover the cattle that aren't as good. A lot of what I have to say about this has been repeated here earlier today because there's been so many folks talk about it. But I do want to talk about, we heard about certified Angus beef. It started out in 1978, struggled like all get out. For about a six-month period, the USDA actually shut the program down. They finally got it back on track, and in early 1980s, they sold their first 1,000,000 pounds of beef. It's projected on September 30th of 2010 that the Certified Angus Beef Program will sell 785 million pounds of product. And I do believe that nearly everyone in this room is a cow, that's a cow-calf person, and I am one, has at some point experienced some value from that program. It has increased the price of cattle. The facts and the data pretty well substantiate that, and any of these economists can certainly provide that information. So that's just that's one example. And that 785 million pounds is 18% above 2009. Now, I don't know about you, but the S&P didn't do 18%, and the Dow didn't do it, and I don't know anything else that it did. But that did because there's consumer demand that pulled that product through the system because of the palatability, the value, and the taste, and the consistency. It met the target. It hits the target for what is very, very saleable. We know, and it was said earlier, that there are these huge differences. Easily $100 between the high and the valued animal in a lot. We see 200, 300, and many times up to 400 bucks. It can go higher, but I'm not talking about extremes here. I'm talking about what you see every day. So we looked at trying to get involved in value-added programs and help our customers get more money for their cattle, and that's exactly what we were able to accomplish. These cattle, because of those highly heritable traits, they can do these things, become involved in these programs. And what really concerns me for a lot of my customers, they're not on the same program. We have some on U.S. Premium. We have some using a grid in other markets and other places. The idea is that they have lots of options. And these programs are not only helping their bottom line and helping their profitability, but I see young people coming back into these operations. When I've made trips to affiliate meetings this spring, I've seen quite a few young people. I didn't expect that. But I see them coming back because I think they're learning how to manage their inventory. They're learning how to manage their risk. And obviously, they're bigger operations. They have to be. There's more families involved when they come back. So there's some fundamentals here that we can't forget. I don't want to take up a lot of time on this. I think I gave you some background of why we did it, what we see. I can tell you that the value per head over the cash market in these programs, many of our customers doing it very consistently. On the conservative side, 40 to 50 bucks, many of them 70 to 80, occasionally better than 100 bucks a head over the cash market. We've seen it. The numbers were mentioned to you earlier. These folks I'm talking about are small to average size producers, and I think by most standards would really be considered small. So these programs are very essential, and as a unit holder in U.S. Premium Beef, does that make me or my customers a packer? Because as U.S. Premium Beef does own a share of National Beef, so if we're a packer, it destroys programs that were absolutely essential to these folks that I think are in a better financial position and doing a better job in terms of the way their banker would look at their operation. I've seen it. I've seen the success in what they've been able to accomplish with it. So that's one thing. And also with those type of programs, there's an annual commitment of a certain percent of those units to U.S. Premium Beef, for example. Well, obviously, that's more than 14 days out. Would that not be permitted anymore by these proposed GPSR rules? So you have those situations, and then I don't want the opportunity taken away from me if I commit some cattle to U.S. Premium, not to be able to commit other cattle on the cash market or any other marketing arrangements I'd like to have. Thank you.
Let me follow up, particularly on behalf of my crowd of suits over here who may not understand the markets as well. Do we need marketing agreements for the types of value-added programs that you're talking about, or can the same goals be arranged through cash markets?
I don't see it happening in the cash market. It didn't happen before. I could say that on occasions in a cash market over the many, many years, you might on a situation have a particular instance where a buyer for a packer might have some prior history on a set of cattle and therefore might bid just a touch more because he thinks that they'll probably do the same thing again. But I will guarantee you it's still a guess. I think I've got a pretty good eye for livestock, and when you look at confirmation, a lot of people out here are the same way. And you think about the muscle that's in them, the retail product, but you're not going to really know that marbling that's in there, the quality grade that creates the value. And it's not till you peel the hide that you really are able to figure or know what the real value of those individuals is. And the business that I've spent the last 25 years in, and many of our customers, is a business of not price discovery, it's value discovery.
Let me go down to the rest of the panel. Do cash markets give appropriate quality incentives?
And our experience at CBP is that we're not only a live cash seller. We market a lot of volume on negotiated grids and on addressed basis as well. So I think when we start talking about premiums, you also got to consider discounts. Yeah. But let's set that aside for a second. The base price generates at least 90% of the value of the cattle, folks. 90%. We have to spend more time focused on that 90%. Yes, let's go satisfy consumer demand and be market-driven and deliver high-quality product for our customers here and around the world. But we have to also consider the procurement behavior region by region that affects the base price. And just real quick, what is happening right now region by region as it relates to non-negotiated volumes. In Texas, right now we're running at about 71-72% of the fed cattle market are marketed on a non-negotiated basis. In Colorado, folks, in Colorado there's a problem. It's 80% right now. Kansas is 63%. Those numbers relate directly to the value of the base price, whether you're negotiating in the open market or the base price of non-negotiated cattle.
Now we still want to really focus in a bit on price discovery and base price and manipulation of base price issues. But I do want to get some focus in here on whether we can get appropriate quality incentives in cash markets. And I'd like to see if we have anybody else with something to say on this.
Let me add just one other thing. People who desire to sell in the cash market want the risk of ownership to stop at the gate. Mm-hmm. And that's a choice that they make. The folks who don't mind and are trustful of the packers' ability to break that animal up and value the carcass and send them something back, do it another way. And just so everybody knows, it's a transfer of risk question as well.
Jim, could I jump back in? Because I agree with what Bruce said down there when he said about discounts in the marketplace. And I'm here to tell you that those of us that have been involved in these kind of programs accepted the risk in the marketplace in the form of discounts for the premiums that were available for the right kind of cattle. And they're huge premiums, and they're very, very worthwhile. So you're absolutely right. There are discounts and there are premiums, and that's exactly why the cash market ends up being an average of the population, because they make the premiums in a lot of cattle cover the discounts. So we wouldn't disagree at all on that, and that is part of the deal that we believe enough in the cattle, the genetics, and the way it repeats itself, and it does, it works, we're willing to take that risk.
The only problem with a lot of the grids and a lot of the premium structures is that there's twice as much of a discount as there is a premium offered. And it ain't all up to the packer. Some of it's up to the grader and things like that. But one of the things with price discovery, if the packers would choose, they were told this years ago already, to go and pay for meat based on what that meat brought at the wholesale price level, you'd have true price discovery, and they'd still be able to make their margin, and the producer would get paid for the quality that he produced.
And I'll answer that one. It's very possible that the wholesale choice box beef price or the retail case price could eventually determine the price, the cash price of cattle.
They've told us that for 15 years. Rosemary Muckle told me 12 years ago or whatever, never going to happen. I don't know.
Well,
let me jump right in while we're on that topic, because I remember hearing earlier, I believe, James Herring, you told me that your base price was cash-based. Is that right?
Well, sure. Most of these formulas are based off the cash, but that's not the only way it can be done.
That's right. Do you see a shift towards pricing?
I see that if the cash market becomes an irrelevant price, and everybody on a formula is very attentive to that, our antenna is 10 feet tall on the cash, if it does not convey appropriate value, then nobody in the formula business is going to stand for that. We'll find a better way. Our differentiation up here on this panel is we don't believe it's the government's job to do that. We believe it's the industry's job to do that. Simple as that.
Well,
anybody else want to jump in on price discovery?
I'm not sure there's a disagreement about that point. The question is, why won't the packers establish the price in a visible market so you can see the bidding happen? Why isn't it transparent? And why isn't that transparency voluntary? And if it's voluntary, it doesn't take regulation. Why is it always reported strictly as history?
Well, I think one of the reasons is, and you heard it earlier from several people, willing buyer, willing seller in a private transaction. This is not the government's role.
When you got
no, there's nothing more private and nothing more public and nothing more fun than an auction with an auctioneer. And that's the way this business grew up. That's the way this business works best. Those are private treaty transactions. And the only reason it doesn't happen that way now is the packer does not want to expose the packer's bid. It's not got anything to do with the government. That point is fundamentally incorrect.
Many times, if you just got that one bid there, you're a seller. But many times I wouldn't call you willing. I mean, it's almost like having to do it with a gun to your head.
Jim, I might jump in here if I could. I want to put a pitch in for the Big Red, Nebraska. We talk about, yeah, there's at least one more out there, right? Talked about the value of mandatory price reporting, and we believe in that. We're all over that. Think it's very important. Would like to see it looked at, studied all the time. Tickled it's being renewed, but we've taken it one step further. When these folks talk about not knowing what the packers are bidding, I want to share with you an example of cattlemen taking care of their own business. And in Nebraska, our Nebraska cattlemen have a mandatory or a market reporting service that people can join. Maybe you guys ought to move to Nebraska and join this thing. And it is a minute-by-minute daily update of the bids in the marketplace. This is a case of us taking care of our own business, creating systems that add value to what we do. And we're talking here about whether they're cash, whether they had a source and age on it, whatever the value was, what the weight was, steers, heifers, whatever. It's a marketing reporting service that we have. We're very proud of it, and it's a way that we help those producers in our country.
Let me shift just slightly, because I really need to bring Charlie Rogers into this, who seems reluctant to argue with everybody else on the panel. Charlie, your business involves auction sales of horses, cows, feeder calves. These fundamental changes that we've talked about in the meatpacking and fed cattle business and trace back to cow-calf, do you see that affecting your business and markets in Southwest?
Well, actually, you know, we could take it to that level. I don't know that we're there yet, but if we continue to see the cash market dwindle, it will have a dwindle down effect into the feeder market and down into the calf market. Yes.
We spent a little. We touched over on several times here on price discovery and shifted over a little bit towards competitive effects of the shifts. Let me start a related issue with that with Bob Miller, which is with small numbers of packers and people still pricing off the cash market. Are you concerned with manipulation of cash market prices that may therefore affect contract prices if they're based off the cash market?
You talking to Bob Miller or Bob?
Bob Miller.
Okay.
It says here on my list.
I would think it would have some effect. I'm not really I can't answer that really intelligently, but I would think it would. Yes, Jim.
Any other reactions on the panel, Bob?
Often. There's a lot of incentive to do it, as you've heard. Most of these formula programs, most of the value-based programs, all go and are based on that cash price. So there's a tremendous incentive. You know, everybody can talk about premiums in these programs, but the big question is how is the base price established before you start adding premiums? Because I've worked with guys on this, and sometimes, you know, it's questionable because if the base price isn't a realistic one, the premium that's quoted isn't a realistic one. And so, I mean, there's a tremendous amount of incentive to go and manipulate that price because of the effect it has on other transactions when you have a thin market. That's why, hopefully, when the Big Red go out on the field Saturday, they've got referees on the field. It'd be nice if USDA would come in and provide some referees for this cattle market.
Jim.
Any other reactions?
Jim, can I?
Might I make one observation? It seems to me that the referees are there. Again, if you go back and look at the most recent GIPSA report, there's an extensive discussion about this very elaborate reporting program, pricing analysis program, for lack of a better term, where they go into great detail about how they analyze virtually every transaction on a weekly basis. And if there is some anomaly in their view, they investigate it. So I would suggest that the referees are there and they are doing their jobs. They have not found anything.
Jim, can I comment, please? You know, when you start talking about a thin cash market, it really is quite simple. And it's you go to the seller who at that point in time is the most distressed. And that's the way that it has been functioning in many areas. And again, it's not unique to the cattle industry. But if you have a distressed seller, and that distressed seller is operating in a very thin market, that distressed seller sets the base price for the entire market.
One of the problems with when it comes to refereeing, if you look at these court cases, juries have said that there's been harm done. I mean, they become the referees. The judges have come in and overturned it because they said, well, it didn't affect everybody in the market. That being the case, if you were a prosecutor out there and somebody murdered someone else, you'd say, I can't prosecute him. It didn't have any effect on everybody else. It just, the only one that hurt is him. So let him go. And well, without this clarification, that's what you got.
Do I get it? Oh, sure. Why not? Well, as a starting point, we are talking about fundamentally different statutes here, so that's sort of one point. I mean, let's face it, that's the elephant in the room today, right? The GIPSA rule. And some people have alluded to it already. You know, on one level, right? You're right, Bob. Eight different federal appellate circuit courts have said this is the standard. They have looked at it carefully. They have analyzed it. I know people up here aren't going to agree with me, but that's what they've concluded. And the fact of the matter is, the way the system works, the statute is what it is. It's been interpreted by all these courts. The most recent ruling was on May 10, 2010. The tide has become a tidal wave, to quote the Sixth Circuit. It's well-settled law. If people don't like the statute, that's fine. But let's have that debate not through some bureaucratic fiat, but let's have that debate in the halls of Congress where it belongs.
We've now found... We've now found a place where I can agree with Mr. Dopp, and that is that the GPSA rules are not the focus of this meeting. This meeting was scheduled a year in advance of the release of those rules. The statute about which we're talking was passed 89 years before those rules. The statute fell into disuse, and any law that falls into disuse is just like a dam in an aggressive stream that you don't tend to. If you don't tend to the dam and take care of it, it gets washed away. That's what's happened here. On May 10th, in the Terry case, the Sixth Circuit decided that because one poultry producer insisted that he be permitted to be present at a Tyson plant to watch the birds he was delivering be weighed, which is his precise right under the regulations, he was scheduled for that weighing at 2 a.m. twice, and they couldn't reach his birds. So they got weighed without him, and he filed suit, and the United States Department of Agriculture and the Grain Inspection Packers and Stockyards Administration supported the producer in the case. And the Sixth Circuit said, because weighing your birds didn't affect the whole market, the statute doesn't apply to you. Now, here's where I agree with Mr. Dopp. The rules that are going to be debated at another meeting are an attempt to reinvigorate the statute, but they are not a statute. There has to be a statute. The problem for the producers who need a stronger statute is the packers have lobbyists.
Well, as do the producers. Oh, well, so do the producers, David. I mean, I work with them. You do too.
No, I don't. I'll make that clear. No, I don't.
Well, to ignore the fact that the rule is out there in this context, I think is a bit, you know, leave it at that. But the fact of the matter is, again, this is an exercise that we are troubled by. We don't think it's within the purview of the Department of Agriculture to try and overturn longstanding judicial precedent. And we will take issue with that, and we think it's inappropriate.
Let me bring us to another sensitive issue.
Oh, by the way, Jim, might I add something?
Sure.
If I recall correctly, the Secretary said this morning that any comments about the GPSA rule would be part of the record for the rulemaking. So I think the GPSA rule is very much in play in this setting.
That's right.
Let me bring it to packer ownership of cattle. Since 1999, according to the GPSA data I see, packer-owned cattle have accounted for 5 to 10% of fed cattle volumes. Now, we've heard allusions to packer ownership of cattle throughout the day. Let me throw this out to the panel. I'll start with a straight question. You think packer ownership affects competition in pricing in cash markets or in marketing agreements? And if it does, tell me how. Anybody want to take that?
Can I start briefly? I think we need to look at the total body of non-negotiated supplies and not just one method. It's a combination of all of the non-negotiated supplies, whether it's the formulated arrangements, the forward contracting, or the packer-owned. Those are the tools that are used in an attempt to reduce the competition in the marketplace.
Let me also say, we contract to producers just like you all sitting in the audience as much as 12 months in advance. I've said publicly that we've contracted cattle that haven't even been born yet because of our database allows us to understand what a producer actually has and produces. So we're a little nervous that the contractual part of these regulations may impact some of our business downstream. Obviously, for us, for our company, the ability to assure supply is a solution that we've passed forward to the packer and to the retailer. and those two entities consider that a benefit, particularly with the kind of cattle that we produce. So when you say contract, I think all of us need to be careful, because that's a very valid way to reduce risk in any operation, cow-calf, stocker, feedlot, et cetera. And we would be very nervous about impacts to contracting forward supply.
Jim, could I very briefly, this morning one of the panelists observed that in the 5% of the hog market that is traded in cash, approximately half of the cash trades are packer to packer. Now, if that trading is open and transparent, and everybody can see it, that may be acceptable. But if it's not, it's unacceptable, and it drives the price down, and that's a risk to the cattle producers too.
All right. I've got a little over 4 o'clock, which was the time we were scheduled to end. I think our panel has done a nice job of keeping...